Hills is our speaker tonight.
My name's Steve Manns and I am alcoholic. And I'd like to first of all and foremost thank the group for having me up to talk tonight. It's a very surreal weekend, and we'll get into a little bit of that in a little bit. But and Lee for his diligence in following up and asking me to come up. And it's always an honor and a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone be able to travel somewhere and tell a little about me and what happened in my journey and my drinking and the way it's been since I got sober. I'd like to welcome any newcomers to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're anything like me, this isn't your first go around. I had several sobriety dates before I got my final one. My sobriety date today is June 11th, 1993. I have a home group. It's the Legacy Group. We meet on Sunday nights. It's a big, very, very formal, very structured speaker meeting in Laguna Hills, and we meet on Sunday nights at 7:30, and we're very proud of that group. I came in and out a little bit, and every time I came in, I swore that I wasn't going to drink again. You know, I burnt my life to the ground, and I swore that I was not going to drink. I swore I'm not going to do it again. You know, I can do this. I know I've got a drinking problem. Never really admitting that I'm a real alcoholic to my innermost self. So if you're new and this isn't your first time, you or me. I'd also like to welcome anybody to the rooms that might be leaving the rooms and they don't even know it, which I believe is more important than those folks that are struggling when they first come in. Because some of us have some time, and you'll hear in my story that during my period of sobriety of over the past 25 years, there's been several bouts where I've left the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And quite frankly, when I was doing it, I didn't even know I was doing it. And I did it one judgment at a time. I did it one decision at a time. I did it one missed call to the sponsor at a time. I did it one missed call back to a sponsee at a time. One missed meeting at a time. And pretty soon I'm pushing God away. And I'm pushing you away. Directly proportionally, by the way, I've found out over the years, as I'm pushing one away, one goes away equally. And then I'm standing all alone on the rooms outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm dying inside. I'm trying to treat my alcoholism with everything imaginable. See, because my alcoholism is going to get treated. It will get treated one way or another. It will get treated with the steps, home group, a God, sponsorship, working with others, or it'll get treated with a plethora of other things, and you'll hear that in my story as well. A little bit of a bio about me. I was born and raised in an upper middle class family, more of a middle class family, in Downey, California, LA County. Really nice neighborhood. Grew up in the 60s and the 70s. I'm 58 years old, so you know the 70s was. I was 10 years old in 1970, so the 70s is when I really grew up. Fondest memories of my childhood are going out to family vacations, and we had a place out at Lake Havasu and boat place out there, and Dad would coach our sporting teams, you know, our basketball, our football, and our baseball teams. Mom would be keeping score on the sidelines. No violence in the family whatsoever inside the household. No alcoholism within the household. It was just a kind, loving family. I couldn't have been loved anymore. I couldn't have been raised in a better family. Dad provided for us, a very, very hard worker, taught me some very, very hard morals on work ethic, and which I carry to this day and I'm proud of. And, it was a great childhood. I do have alcoholism that runs in the family, and I'll share that with you real quick. I've seen the progression of this illness in two different forms. First form was my grandmother on my dad's side, his mother. When I was born, she was, and I can't diagnose her as alcoholic, but let's just say she was one of us. And my dad gave her the ultimatum: you either put the plug in the jug or you're never going to see your grandkids again. Simple as that. She did exactly that. She put the plug in the jug. 17 years forward, her daughter died. My dad's sister passed away suddenly from a brain aneurysm. She pulled the plug out of that jug and she was dead in 3 months. It's So I have no doubt that this disease is progressive, that this illness is progressive, whether I'm drinking or I'm not drinking. Other side, my mom's side, her brother, who I take after identically, look like him, talk like him, act like him, drink like him, drank himself to death at the age of 51 years old and never tried to get sober. I remember my growing up, and I was about 18 years old when he passed, and going and seeing him in the hospital, the Veterans Hospital in Long Beach, the day before he died, and he's yellow as a banana, and the doctor's, you know, saying, we don't know, the only thing keeping him alive is his heart, every other organ is shut down, and he persistently drank, and ended up doing the deal and passing from this illness. So I have no doubt that this is a progressive illness, and see, that's the funny thing about my disease as I know it today, is that it not only is my drinking progressive, but so is my behavior. See, and my behavior is progressive in nature also. If I'm not treating that alcoholism, like I said before, with those steps and all those things that we do around here in the rooms, then that my behavior progresses. See, to watch me drink, I'm just a bad, bad drunk. But you want to see my alcoholism? Watch me when I'm not drinking. And that's when you're going to see my alcoholism, right? When I put the plug in that jug and I start this journey of sobriety is when things get real complicated, right? And so I grew up in this nice, kind, loving family, and went real fast forward. I wish I could tell you that, you know, I have this great story and, you know, I've been to prison or I've been, you know, I was an astronaut or I was a race car driver or, you know, anything fancy like that. But that's not me. I'm just a good old drunk. And, you know, all I know is that I'm alcoholic. And when I take a drink, something different happens to me than happens to the normal person. You know, our book describes it as that mental obsession with the, you know, coupled with the physical allergy, and, you know, and I get really thirsty right around the end of that first drink, and then about the end of the second drink, I'm really thirsty, and I want to keep going. And I don't know when I'm going to stop. And it didn't start out like that. You know, I was in high school. I played sports. I was very active. I've always been the chameleon. I could always fit in any group that there is. You know, I could be fitting in with the jocks because I played sports, or I could hang out on Loser's Corner. You know, it's the one right out there. There's one on every school. There's one right across the street where all the smokers and the drinkers and the weed smokers and all them guys hang out over there. I could fit in both places really, really easy. Anywhere I wanted to fit in, I fit in really well. Another baffling thing about, you hear from our members share from the podium a lot, is that they always felt like they didn't fit in. And I always felt like I fit in. I never felt like I didn't fit in. Like I said, I could weed my way into any group that I wanted and feel very comfortable there. So I went through high school and never got in any trouble. Downey's a very small town. My godfather, who I called my uncle, he was my dad's best friend from kindergarten, and he's more of an uncle than I ever had. He was a ranking officer in the police department there in Downey, and he got me into this little, be a little junior cop there when I was like 13, 14 years old. And so I knew all the police officers in town, and Downey's known for not having very, very friendly police officers, right? And if you didn't belong there, you got in big trouble. Well, you know, they kind of left the people that belong there alone. And so I never really got into trouble. You know, had a couple interactions with them, but nothing very, nothing bad at all. When I turned 18 years old in my senior year in high school in April, and my brother's girlfriend at the time, now his wife, his future father-in-law was a big wig at the phone company. He was a GTE, and he had gotten my brother a job, and he said, "Look, when you graduate, you know, I got you a place. All you got to do is just get your diploma," which was not a problem. I was going to graduate with no problem. So I take the test in between April and June, and I graduate on a Thursday night in June, and I start working on Monday morning. Right? So I'm on a big boy job. I'm working for a major utility company. I'm a punk 18-year-old kid, 3 months into 18 years old, 3 days out of high school, literally 3 days out of high school, and now I'm thrown into this world of adults, and I'm an installer repairman. And, you know, and you know, these guys were old. They were in their late 20s and 30s. And shoot, there was even guys that worked out there, they were in their 40s, right? And one guy was even, I think he was late 50s, right? And that's where I landed. And, you know, of course, my chameleon came out of me and I fit right in. And, you know, I grew up very, very fast. I met my my future wife there. I went fishing from the company pier and got a hookup and reeled her in. And by age 20, we were married. But prior to that, When I was an installer, I'd watch these guys come rolling into the yard where we parked our trucks in these big trucks, right? These big boom trucks, right? And these guys were big and they were burly and they were dirty when they came in. And who are they? Who are they? You know, those are the linemen. You don't even look at them, right? I mean, they'll suck you into the abyss and you'll never come out, right? Those guys are the knuckle draggers. That's what they call them, the knuckle draggers. They're the heavy gang. That's what their nickname was, the heavy gang. And I thought, that's what I want to do, right? That's my future. And 9 months into my career, I had an opportunity to transfer into that department. And boy, I had arrived. These guys knew how to drink, and they drank on the job, and everybody knew it, but nobody said anything to them because they were just, everybody's afraid of them. You know, it was like that's like the unspoken people over there. And I fell into this, and I fit right in. I'm 19 years old. I'm not even 21, barely 20 years old. And I fit right in with them as well, and I loved that job. It was a great job, and I grew up really fast in that department, and through my 20s, I got married at 20 years old, and life was on, because that's what I thought we were supposed to do. That's what everybody else was doing at the phone company, right? Everybody had a wife and a house and a picket fence and a couple of children and a dog, and that's what grown-ups do. And I wasn't grown up at all, and that marriage was never real stable from the beginning. And by the way, I want to thank my children who are here tonight. They're a big part of my story. My daughter lives in the area here. I'll get to that. But at age 25, we have our first child, and he's sitting right here now, and he's 32 years old. And now my illness is progressing a little bit. I'm not drinking heavy yet. By the age 30. Marriage is really, really rocky, and we have our daughter, and she's sitting right here in the front row as well. So I'm 30 years old, now we have these two children, and I'm in bad shape. I'm drinking a lot, right? So the ex-wife puts up with me for about another year, and I'm doing the deal. I'm doing what we do when we're out there doing it, right? I'm disappearing for a couple days at a time, not coming home. Parking the car on the lawn, and she's taking care of the kids as much as possible, and things are really, really, really bad. And one weekend, we had a big blowout. I moved out, or I kind of left for a day, and I came back the next day, and the house was empty. And she had taken those kids, and they left. Right? And these kids are the love of my life. Right? I love these kids with all my heart. But see, I'm alcoholic. And I was in the grips of a progressive illness that I had no solution for, and I needed a drink. I went around the corner to my watering hole liquor store, and I got me a handle of vodka, and I partied in that empty house for 3 days, solid, and not knowing where they were, not having any idea where they were. I came to just a little bit, and I called, did what every big bad lineman does, right? And I called mommy. And says, mommy, mommy. I'm pretty sure there's a few guys in here that's called mommy, right? You, maybe not, but where I come from, you called mommy, right? And see, because that dad that I had, that I loved so dearly and was my best friend, in 1988 he became ill, and say 87 he became ill, and he passed away in 88, and I lost my best friend, and so mom was there alone, and with my little sister who I have. She was adopted when I was 11 years old, and she was 4 days old, and we adopted her and brought her home from the hospital, and that was the love of my life as well growing up. And so they lived in my old house that I grew up in, and called mommy up and said, mommy, mommy, I don't know where the kids are. I don't know where she is. The house is empty. I have no place to go. Come home, son, and we'll take care of it. Everything will be okay. She had no idea what the monster she was letting in the front door. See, by this time, I'm drinking on an hourly basis. I can't go more than a few hours without a drink. I'm in dire trouble at work. Nobody wants to work with me. Everybody says I'm unsafe. They're putting up with me, but they're, barely putting up with me. And see, we're operating heavy equipment, we're climbing poles, we're, you know, other people rely on each other in that kind of business. And and nobody wanted to work with me. And so about a week into staying with Mom, you know, I'm going to work, coming home, drinking, disappearing again with her, coming home. And I come home one day and she says, "Hey, I ran into this lady, that old friend of the family, and their daughter was my age. I dated her in high school." And they said, "Hey, I'm Brandon." And she says, "Claudia is a single mom, just like you, a single dad. Give her a call. Here's her number." And I mean, it's been a couple of weeks. I'm lonely. And so I call her up. And she lives way down in South Orange County, right? I'm in Downey. And I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but it's, you know, it's a little trek. And so I call her up and she says, "Well, what are you doing right now?" And I says, "I'm free." And she says, "Well, why don't you come down? We'll go to dinner." And so that's exactly what I did, right? Ended up bringing my toothbrush and leaving it there and spending the night and driving home in the morning and going to work. And that was to be my next story for the next about 9 months. Now, Claudia partied. She was an alcoholic. And she let me in, right? And she had no idea what she was letting in the door. And it wasn't long before she came in one day and she says, "You know, Steve, it's not normal to have a bottle of vodka on the nightstand when you go to sleep. And when you wake up, to take two big chugs off of it and barely keep it down so you can drive back to work and start your day." And I said, she said, "That's not really normal. I have this friend at work whose husband hasn't had a drink in 13 years and he goes to this AA thing. And he's been sober a long time and he loves to take people to these meetings. Right? I think you need to go." Well, I'm not a dumb guy, right? I think it's... I got pretty smart and I figure out that, okay, the heat's coming, right? I've got the heat at work. I got the heat by Mom. I got the heat by Claudia. You know, by this time, the kids are kind of back in my life. The ex is not really trusting me, but she's allowing me a little bit of custody here and there. And they're going down with me on weekends. And we had this big Brady Bunch family thing going on. And it was, so I go to these, thank God for our solid elders in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who do this deal the way it's supposed to be done. This gentleman's name is Patrick. And every Tuesday night, him and his buddy Wes would come by in the car and they would pick me up and they would drive me to this men's meeting, right? At the time, Patrick had 13 years sober. Wes had about 8 years sober. And I was the brunt of their jokes, like we are most of the time when we're new. And I'd get in that back seat of that car and they'd laugh at me and they'd say, "Ha ha, Steve, so what's your sobriety date next Tuesday?" And they knew I was drinking, but you know what? They were doing what they were supposed to do. All they were doing is being the example and being the message, right? They knew that I wasn't ready. At this point, you know, I did this for a little while and at this point, the heat was still coming on because I'm still drinking and I knew it wasn't going to be long before it was going to get real hot. So I figured, okay, I got to do something. And somebody recommended, well, you know, they have these treatment places in rehabs, they call them. You know, rehab is where you go for your knee. Treatment is where you go for alcoholism, right? But they start this treatment I did my little treatment cycle. First one was an outpatient. I wasn't really committed enough to do the inpatient. They told me, "Well, I think you need to be inpatient and, you know, we need to detox you." Oh, no, I'm good. I'll do the outpatient thing. That's, you know, 3 nights a week and a couple day follow-ups and I'm good to go, right? And I was drinking through that whole thing. And I had a counselor in that program. God bless him. Rowdy Yates is his name, was his name. He's passed now. We had this family night. And of course, the only family I have is Mom, right? So Mom's goes with me. And I see Rowdy and Mom's talking in a corner, right? And of course, I know they're talking about me, right? Because it's all about me. And so they're talking about me. And I had no idea what they said, and I didn't ask, and we went our merry way. And from this point on, I did 3 more treatment centers within the next 7 months. And those were inpatient programs, and they went something like this. I'd go in, they'd spin-dry detox me, they'd give me my Librium, my Valium, all those nice meds, those detox meds that they give the people in the treatment centers these days. And this was a long time ago. This was over 25 years ago, 26 years ago. They give me all those nice meds and it'd cool me down a little bit and spin dry me and I'd start to feel and the shakes would go away. And then I'd look around and I'd find her and we'd be gone and be drunk in 48 hours. right? And that happened 3 times in a row. Fast forward to May of 1993. You know, our big book talks about, you know, we're going to reach a point that we can't imagine our lives with alcohol, we can't imagine our lives without alcohol. That we're going to come to that jumping off place. You know, supreme sacrifice. And I came to that place. But I'm a coward. I can't put a bullet in my head or, you know, jump off a bridge or a building or anything, run my car into a bridge abutment. I'm a coward. So, Uncle Dwayne, he drank himself to death. I could do that. I can drink, and I can drink hard, right? And I'm going to do that, and I'm going to drink hard. This is before the movie Leaving Las Vegas. I love that movie because it tells my story. So I decided to get myself a rack of booze, a bunch of handles of vodka, lock myself in a Super 8 motel room, and proceed to drink myself to death, right? One problem with that, it takes a very long time. And, it's very, very painful. Our sponsor, Lee and I's sponsor, says, you know, trying to drink yourself to death is like being kicked to death by rabbits. It's very long and very painful and very tedious. And I was in there for probably, and what I remember about, sure a little bit about what I remember about that, about a week and a half that I was in that room, is that I remember drinking myself into sleep, a blackout, just passing out, coming to, drinking myself to pass out, coming to. But I remember sitting on that bed, and there was a dresser with a mirror. Right? And I remember share about, I looked in the mirror and I saw the shell. You know, I saw this hollow person. That's not what I saw at all. I saw me. I saw what I had become. I saw the true alcoholic Steve. I saw this man that was full of shame and full of guilt and full of remorse and just, it was horrifying. It was horrifying. And I drink myself into another stupor and then wake up and do the same thing over. Well, I got a knock at the door and I'm thinking they can't be giving me more towels because I'm not showering. And I've got the do not disturb sign out, right? And I'm going to go yell at the housekeeping lady. And I open up the door, and who's there standing there? Moms, right? Good old moms. She tracked me down later to find out that on one of my blackout nights, she had put me in that hotel to get me out of the house. And I had found my way back there. You know, we're like creatures of habit. You know, we're like, we just go back to our little coals. And I found myself back in that hotel room. And she says, come with me. You're going to go to this place. Go to that place, I believe she called it, that place. And I had no idea what she was talking about, right? And but, you know, I believe in anybody that's sober or been around a little while, or there's a time when desperation meets willingness, and God's grace steps in. And I had just enough willingness and I had just enough desperation that God's grace stepped in. And she says, get in the car. And I got in the car. I took a couple pulls off that bottle first because I had a feeling I was going to one of those places again. So she drives me across town, across Downey, over into Norwalk. And I don't know if anybody knows familiar with the city of Norwalk, but it's famous for one thing. And that is Metropolitan State Hospital, the Norwalk Nut House, right? And I'd known this. I grew up right next to, I knew. She turned through that gate, and I thought, oh, God, okay, this is the place, that place, right? And she made another left turn, and then made a right turn, and she slowed down and opened the door, and I rolled out, and there was this big sign that says Cider House on the Cider House Detox on the front wall, right? And she said, she gassed it, right? And she says, don't call me, I'll call you. And I could tell she meant it that time. She really, really meant it. I'd heard it before, but, you know, I could always smooze her. And away I went. And, I crawled into that detox, and I says, look, I need help. I need a bed. So he said, we happen to have a bed available. And so they started their intake on me. And, you know, immediately I said, look, man, it's been about an hour since I had a drink. I'm good for about 3. 2, I'm going to start shaking. 3, it's going to get real ugly. Right? So I need to see that doc right away. I need my Valium. I need my Librium. I need those detox meds. You know, right now I need to see that doctor. Right? And the guy was so gracious. I can still remember him today. His name was James. He was my first sponsor. He said, "No, Steve, that's not this kind of detox. We're what we call a social model detox. We have this little glass of honey water. You can drink it, and it'll take the edge off. And I says, well, I don't think you understand, Skippy. This is going to get ugly. And it's going to get ugly real fast, right? I've been known to have seizures. I've been known to not, you know, be real good when it starts, when I start having grand mal seizures and start really the delirium tremens and the whole nine, right? Because I've been drinking really hard for a really long time. And well, they put me in this little room. It used to be a padded cell. It was about a 12 by 12 room. You could still see the rivets on the wall where they had the pads riveted onto the wall, right? They had three mattresses in that room, one in the back, two on either side, and the mattress was on the ground. Didn't have a box spring, didn't have a frame, right? Later to find out that they put those mattresses on the ground because they expected people to have seizures, and when you rolled out of bed, you weren't going to hurt yourself too bad, right? You didn't have to roll too far, right? So for the next 5 days, I spent in that, they call it the wet dorm, I spent in that wet dorm, shaking, seeing things crawling on the walls. It was the most horrific experience that I've ever had in my life, and I wouldn't change anything for the world. It was exactly what I needed to feel, because I never, ever want to feel. And they told me this, Steve, you go through this, you never have to feel this way again. I'd heard that before, but I never really heard it before. And they're absolutely, they didn't lie to me. They said, you know what, we'll stand you up. And we'll prop you up until you can get better. We'll feed you. We'll let you suck out of a straw so you can drink water and drink this honey water until you start feeling better. And that's exactly what they did. And they nursed me back to health. And for 11 days, I was in that detox, and I had an opportunity to go upstairs into what they called the primary program. It was a 60-day lockdown program. It wasn't really lockdown. You could leave anytime you want. You just couldn't come back. And that's what I did. It was an all-men's program, so I was safe there. And it was my greatest experience ever. I went from that 60-day program. I did steps 1, 2, and 3 while I was in that program. I got out. They had another building over on the other side of the grounds called Supportive, right? And that Supportive was another building they leased from the state. And that every Thursday night, they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in that over at that building. We would walk over while we were in that program. We would walk over to that meeting. It was the Chuck Gaber Memorial Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a podium participation meeting, and the leader came up and he shared a little bit, and then he called on people in the audience. And you know, I walked over to that meeting the very first time with about 12 days sober. The very first gentleman that greeted me as I came up said, "Hi, I'm Bud McDonald, and welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'll never forget that man. He had at that time 44 years sober. And see, I think we all forget that sometimes, and when we get sober and we get around here a little ways. That we need to walk that extra step across the room when that new guy walks in the room and say, "Hi, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." See, because he was the first face that I really saw in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not those meetings that I went to with Patrick, this meeting. And you know, and it changed my life. And you know, and I ended up being secretary of that meeting later on, and I was committed to that meeting. It was my home group for many years. And long story what happened to that meeting, but you know, I moved over into that Supportive after I finished that 60-day program stayed there for 3 months. Now, you know, they say don't make any rash decisions. I did. And, you know, there was a gal there, she did chips. She had a house. I needed a house. Her name was Carol. She was my older woman experience, let's just say that. And I was 33, she was 48. I think about that today, and I think, oh my God, she's 73. If we would have stayed together, wow. We're still in contact. We still talk to each other. But I moved in with her, and it was exactly what was supposed to happen. You know, it's funny because in my sobriety over the last 25 years, and if I look in the rearview mirror, every situation that I've been in the 25 years. Is exactly where I'm supposed to be. The problem is that sometimes I can't see my relationship with it when I'm in it, right? I can't see my relationship with it until I'm free of it. And so I was with Carol there for a little while, and then some things happened, and you know, about a year and a half I lived there, and then I was going to another meeting, and you know, you're gonna say, oh my God, this guy works the most horrible program in the world. which at times I do. But I was a secretary of a meeting at that old program, the very first program, New Beginnings it was called, where I did my outpatient. And I saw a gal come in and detox, right? And I even joked with the guy, Buck, the guy that I used to run with back when I first got sober. And I said, "Hey, Buck, there she is, man. Sorry, guys, she's with me," right? And I was joking, right? And she was new, and I wasn't going to move. I knew better than to get somebody new. So I waited a year. I did. And I asked her out, and the rest is history with there. And some of my wife, Dawn, is who I'm married to today. And anyway, so we move in together right after that. And now's where it really gets interesting. I'll kind of fast forward through this part because I want to get on some step work. I've been working the steps actively with a sponsor to this point, right? I did my first three steps in that program. I did the best four step that I could possibly do, right? I had no problem with the conception of God because I was raised, baptized, and confirmed Lutheran. So I knew that there was a God out there. I just didn't think that he had anything to do with little old me, right? Because I'd done all these horrible, horrific things. And, you know, he couldn't love me that much. Otherwise, he wouldn't have put me through what he put me through, right? So I came to terms with that, and I did my fourth step, and I identify those character defects, you know, in the fourth step, and I do my fifth step with my sponsor, and bring God into it, and everything's good, and I go home, and I do six and seven, and just like the book says, straight out of the book of our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I build that list. And here's where it starts to get interesting, right? I've got a lot on my plate, right? I got a lot I got to make up for. You see, because when I came in here, with a lot of stuff on my plate. I didn't share, you know, with you that little sister of mine that was 4 days old that I took the day we took brought her home from the hospital, I took her to my sixth grade class, you know, and told her, "This is my new baby sister," and the love of my life, and I adored her throughout my whole life. And she tried to take a bottle from me one night when I was living at mom's house, and I threw her through a plate glass window. And almost cut her foot off, right? And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I could go on and on about how I hurt and harmed people. That's just the physical harm. I'm not even talking about the mental, you know, harm and the abuse that I put people through, and the sleepless nights and the money problems and on and on. And so I'm building that list, and I start doing those amends, and they're going good. And I try to work a 10th step every day, and 11th, and I'm working with other alcoholics, and then. You know, I get with Don, and we relocate, and, you know, the phone company even, you know, I was going from almost losing my job. They promoted me in 1997. They said, "You know, you're such a great employee. We're going to promote you." So they promoted me to be a first-line manager, and so Don and I move in together, and we were down to South Orange County, and I'm commuting back and forth, and that job's really important. Job's really important, and the title's really important, and I got to show them how good I am, and see, I left my program up in LA County, and I'm down in Orange County, and pretty soon the separation starts. And it started getting bigger. And that was the first time that I'm sitting on the outside of our rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous looking in, going, "What the hell happened?" And so I re-engage with the sponsor, get back in the steps. I'd like to say that only happened once. It didn't. I was in that same position from 1997 to 2005, and they came to me and they said, "Hey, Steve, you know, we've been grooming you. We want to promote you again." Okay. They shouldn't give me this department to start up, and I'm this big shot on campus again, and one more time I start falling back. This time, you know, I shared with you earlier that my illness is progressive, and so is my behavior. This time the behavior's progressing even more, right? So I've pushed God out of my life, and I've pushed you out of my life, and this job is my focus. And see, the funny thing about my illness is that my alcoholism will get treated one way or another. You know, like I said earlier, it will get treated with steps, Alcoholics Anonymous, a loving God, a home group, sponsorship, sponsoring other guys, all of that stuff, right? It'll get treated. That will treat my alcoholism or a plethora of other things. So I go on this spiritual destructive journey in about 2006, and I did more spiritual harm in a year than I ever did in my whole drinking career with the ones closest to me. I um, I found myself in Las Vegas, Nevada on a weekend where it was the Men's International Convention there. I was supposed to go up there with a couple of guys and they backed out at the last minute and I said, I got to go. I didn't know if I was going to come home to a place to live. I didn't know if I was going to come home to a relationship. I didn't know what I was coming home to. But I was going anyway. So I went. The very first speaker I heard that Friday night was Lee and I's sponsor, and that's Bob D. And it was like I was the only guy in the room, and he was just talking right at me, right? And he was telling me exactly what I suffer from, and that's self, right? See, because that is the root of my problem. All that self is just my self will bubble up in many aspects of my life. It'll bubble up through ego. It'll bubble up through work. And there are many ways, places that my self will bubble up, and I was just so consumed in self that I had no room for anything else, nothing else. Because when I'm consumed itself, you can't get in, God can't get in, nobody can get in. Steps can't get in, alcoholics cannot, nothing can get in. So the very next morning, the next speaker I heard was a good friend of mine today. He's a Ralph W. And he's a dear friend of mine today. And it was like I was the only guy in the room again, right? And Ralph's story was almost parallel to mine. And, you know, about his daughter and his children and all of that. And I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. And about a week later, I got Bob's phone number that weekend, and I came home and things started working out at home. And I called Bob up and I said, hey, you know what? He said, well, I'm coming to town. I'll be in Seal Beach in a week. Why don't you come and see me? So I went and saw him, and I said, look, I'm dying. I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and I need help, right? So he started me on this journey, a new journey, and he gave me some exercises to do and about my prejudices and myself, and yeah, it's just, so he plugged up some holes in the steps, and like he always does, and he's brilliant at that, and finding out where the root of the problem is, and I've been with that man ever since, and I've tried to remain reasonably sponsorable throughout that time. I really have. But again, I'm self-absorbed. And I have to tell in myself that it's not always that easy to be the grand sponsee and make that phone call. And because the only thing it requires is at least one phone call a week, right? My call is on Mondays at 3:30, and I make them pretty regularly, but when I don't make them, I don't make them, right? Because one week turns into two, and it's like, oh God, now he's going to be mad. Yeah. Now I can't talk to him, right? Fear sets in, right? So I'll tell you a little bit about what happened recently. In 2010, I was this high roller, don't you know? And they promoted me again. I was an operations manager, and I'm doing the deal, and I had 125 regular employees, 250 contractors, 12, 14 managers reporting to me, a couple of consultants reporting to me, and I was responsible for half the state of California, and they came to me one day and says, we're reducing our force. And, there's two of you that do your job. The other guy does the other half of the state of California. One of you are not going to be here. And I thought, oh, okay, well, which one is it going to be? And they says, we can't announce that. But you're eligible to retire. And if you take this package now, you will get these things, right? If you don't take this package and you're it, you won't get these things. Now, I kind of figured it out, and the other guy was a lot closer to the big boss than I was, even though I started the department. So I knew that I knew what the time it was and what the number that was up. And I was never going to get offered this package again. I'm 50 years old. I've got almost 33 years with this company. And I lose my job, right? I retire early. It sounds like glamorous, right? But bottom line is I just bailed myself out to get a little extra money because I knew that I was the guy that was getting the axe. And what I didn't share with you is 13 days prior to that, my wife lost her job, right? And she was an upper-level manager for a major toy manufacturer in Southern California here. And we went from 2 six-figure incomes to unemployment in 13 days. Now, I'm good with God, right? But sometimes fear just kind of smothers his voice out, right? Especially when it comes to financial fear. Now, I will say today that all through all that, you know, every time I've turned the light switch on, the lights have come on, and every time I've been asked to come and talk somewhere, I had gas in the gas tank. And every time a newcomer called me and my phone was working, and you know, and so God has taken care of me. So 9 months after that, and I swore that I was never going to set foot on another phone company property. I swore it. On my father's grave, I'm not going to do it, right? I'm done with the phone business. I'll find something else. So I start to pursue another career, and that's when I'm going to get my captain's license, and I'm going to teach diving. I'm an avid scuba diver. I've dove since I was 15 years old. So 43 years I've been diving, and I'm going to become an instructor, and I'm going to drive boats, and I'm going to marry those two together, and I'm going to move off to some faraway land 6 months out of the year, some Palau or you know, Indonesia or somewhere nice and sunny, and I'm going to do that, right? And I'm come home for 6 months, leave for 6 months, come home for 6 months. And the wife's good with it. She's fine with it. And so I started this pursuit. Well, 6 months later, it's going to be a very long pursuit, right? So I get this random phone call from a company that said, hey, would you like to teach? We've got this opportunity that, you know, we got your name from somebody and we heard that you're just what we're looking for. How would you like to teach for AT&T, the competitor from the company I retired from? And I said, well, you know what? I'll give it a shot. Wallet's getting a little thin. Okay, we can do that, right? So that set off this journey for the next 5 years, and I was teaching for AT&T and traveling all over the state doing that. And that started this next slow little decline, right? Now, at 21 years sober, now I'm a contractor, right? So if I don't work, I don't get paid. Now, I was pretty much on the schedule every week, but that just in the back of my, see my, that mind just goes and goes and goes, that chatter. Well, what if you don't work next week? Well, if you don't work next week, what happens if they don't schedule the week after that? Okay, you can make 1 week, but can you make 2 weeks? Well, what if they don't do 2 weeks? Well, can you make 3 weeks? You know, so my mind's just rattling, right, all the time. For 5 years, it's doing this. And I'm start going back into self. I'm teaching diving on the weekends when I'm coming home on the weekends, and I'm working for a major sports LA. They're out of business now, and teaching diving for them on the weekends, and still pursuing that driving the boat thing, and so it's my nuts. I'm going nuts, and I'm sitting in a hotel room in San Leandro, California, consumed in self, consumed in fear. Just locked up, right? And my phone rings, and it's one of my sponsees. I hit ignore, and it terrified me. I thought, that's the one thing that's gonna save my life on the other end of that phone, and I'm declining the call. I'm declining the call that's gonna save my life. And it scared the hell out of me at 21 years sober, and I started the new journey again. Again, we get back and get in shape, and that's been good for the last 4 years. that training job lined out, it kind of bled out, and they weren't hiring any more people, so an opportunity came up. Well, guess what the opportunity was? Steve, how would you like to be a lineman again? Where you started at 18 years old, right? So I'll just give you a little brief thing about that. I am, because it's what I'm dealing with today on an everyday basis. So I start this lineman job 2 years ago, and you know, I've got 42 years in this business. I'm very experienced. Is my ego talking now? I was my boss's level, right? And now I'm the lineman, right? And everybody that's where I work with knows that. Now I have to really look at myself, because why don't I get along with these people, right? Why does everybody resent me? Why aren't they treating me with the respect that I deserve? Why aren't they recognizing my 42 years experience in this business and flourishing on that instead of pushing me aside and giving me all the grunt work? That's what my head tells me. And you know, it's very difficult to deal with that. And with 25 years sober, this is the things that I struggle with today. Again, consumed in self. Where am I in that? My ego. Huge, huge, big part of it. My ego tells me I'm better than the rest of them, right? That don't you know? When really, I'm just a worker among workers. Now, that boat thing has flourished. I was able to upgrade that license last year, and I worked for two charter companies on weekends and at night, and that diving thing I kind of put on hold. I can't really do both at the same time, but I'm driving boats, and I'm ready to retire again, really retire. And the only thing stopping me is, again, is fear. And why am I so fearful? It's because I don't have that trust in God, right? I'm not trustworthy enough that God is going to do what he's supposed to do. And that's the bottom line, that I'm not trusting he's going to do what he's supposed to do. I love working with other alcoholics. I've got several sponsees, and I don't decline their calls. When I take their calls, just like anybody who's got a few sponsees knows, you know, at any given time, you know, there's 60% of them to 70% of them are kind of like off the grid, and then call you when their butts against the wall, right? It's like, oh my God, you don't know what's happening, do you? No, I don't. You haven't called me in 3 weeks. Oh, it's her. Who's her? Oh, it's that girl I met in the detox. You know, her, right? I can't go back there anymore. They told me I'm not welcome there. Well, I wonder why. We call that being predative behavior, right? And I love working with other alcoholics. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to share a little bit about, you know, what it's like today and my life in today's world. I shared about those children. This morning I got up and I drove up and picked my son up. He lives in Santa Paula. He's getting ready to move to Washington. So I don't know when I'm going to see him again until he flies down or I go up. I was able to pick him up. We drove up here together, had some nice conversation. I'm staying at my daughter's house, who lives around the corner, right? Who's married to my son-in-law, who I love dearly, who they've given me this wonderful little grandchild, right? Now, if you don't think that there's a God, right? Their next door neighbor is sitting in the front row over here. Stay with me for a second. My son-in-law's brother used to date Jessica's sister. So they know my son-in-law's family, right? There's like too many gears in these cogs, right? But I just know that there's a God that comes in. And because sometimes I think that we forget why we come to these meetings, you know. They say that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that families will be restored and their lives will be restored, and you know, that we're going to know a new freedom and a new peace. And I think that we forget what happens when we come to these meetings. So, you know, some little girl or some little boy is getting ready to have mommy or daddy come home. Some mommy or daddy's going to get a good night's sleep tonight because they know their daughter or son's safe. Some employer's going to get ready to have a hell of an employee come back. Probably not for long because they'll get into self like I did. But really, seriously, they're going to have a hell of an employee come back in the workforce. Who wouldn't want to be a part of this life-changing experience? If you're new, all I can tell you is you don't have to drink no matter what, as long as you're willing to accept a few simple conditions. They're very simple. I don't know where my life would be without Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know more where my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous would be. All I know is that I love my kids to death. And I would, you know, I love what my friend Carl says, and I'm going to plagiarize this and I'm going to steal this from him because I love it. Because I love those kids with all of my heart, and I would take a bullet for those kids, right? And I wouldn't trade those kids for the first drink for anything in the world. But I'd trade them for the second drink Just like that. Just like that. You know, I am truly, truly blessed in my life, and I know that God works freely. I know He works through me. I know He puts you in my life. I know He puts people in my life exactly where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. And all I have to do is just get out of the way. I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety. I want to thank you for my freedom. I want to thank you for having me up here to share. Thank you. Right on.